So we're in the middle of chapter 8 of Revelation. For those of you who haven't been attending with us every week, I hate to even try to do a synopsis of what we've discussed because we've discussed so many things. I'm a little lost. I'm like, where do I begin? And I don't know that I can remember everything. I'm going to just start with chapter 7. We dealt with the 144,000, which we believe were a distinct group from the great crowd that no one can number.
Mm-hmm.
And that the sealing, of course, is very important to the rest of the story. I almost feel like asking Floyd to take over at this point and try to recap. Do you have anything to add to that, Floyd? Without getting into the whole thing over again.
Yeah, there's so many things. The sealing is very important. And I think this is the introduction of the official introduction of the 144,000 that keeps showing up, mm-hmm. you know, throughout the rest of the story.
Yes.
I like to call them the Lamb Special Ops Forces.
Mm.
So this is like their grand entrance onto the stage.
Mm. Like
and the sealing process and of course the holding back the winds is a very important part,
mm-hmm.
which then shows up later when they finally release the winds. There's a lot of threads that get started here that that are going to keep showing up.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, we are ready for just start in the middle of the four plagues, the first four trumpet plagues, I should qualify. One thing I'd like to mention from last week is there's images in here that relate to the death of Jesus on the cross, the earthquake, mm-hmm. for example, and the thunder voices and lightning. Of course, I get the voices from, I think, Desire of Ages or else one of her other books on the Great Controversy.
I actually wrote down a bunch of questions.
You did. So refresh my memory. Where did we end last week?
Well, we started talking about the angel and the censer and all that.
But we didn't finish.
I didn't think we finished it.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. We read, I think, to the terrible earthquake with the announcement of the seven trumpets, but I don't know if we satisfied the discussion.
Right. Okay, let's start over then. We'll just start with chapter 8, verse 1.
I mean,
we did do the silence for half an hour.
Right, right.
And yeah. Floyd sent me, I think he sent all of us, except those who are new, the statement by Ellen White, where half an hour equals 7 days in if you use prophetic time. So if that's 7 days, then Ellen White seems to use that to indicate that it will take 7 days to tour the universe on our way to the New Jerusalem. But then there's another statement. There's another time of silence that's quite intriguing. It's when Jesus comes in all his awesome glory and everybody is standing there and it's the saints are in utter awe, and their faces turn pale, and they say, "Who shall be able to stand?" And there's silence, a long silence, according to what this statement says.
Mm.
Maybe, Floyd, you could send that around again to the class.
Okay. The latest
edition of the class. That's intriguing. Mm-hmm. And Floyd, do you want to say what you thought it had to do with kind of washing out?
Yeah, I think just psychologically, for me, putting myself in that situation, the kind of stuff that's going to come up, because, you know, you've believed, you've been living by faith, you know, that, but when it really comes down to it, and you see him and he doesn't say anything. all those residual doubts and questions are swirling around. And I think that's actually, it's intentional, because he is allowing all that residual fear and doubt to surface, sort of like the slag, you know, coming out of the purifying process, and it all floats to the top and it needs to drain off. So that the perfect reflection can be seen. And I think it's very intentional, and it could well be literally a half an hour. I don't know.
At any rate, it's an whether it relates to the half an hour in Revelation or not, we don't know, but it's an interesting thing to think about, that God is purifying that last bit so that we are completely ready to hear him say, "My grace is sufficient for you."
Mm-hmm.
And that's what leads the saints. It's not here in Revelation, but it's elsewhere in the Bible. This leads the saints to say, "Look, this is our God. This is our God." Not that other imposter that showed up claiming to be Christ, but this is our God.
The gentle one.
Yes. The one whose grace is sufficient. The one who has taught us to live by grace through faith.
And we waited for him to show up because we rejected all the other versions.
That's right. We waited for you, and you will save us.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're ready now. Bill, why don't you go ahead and read verse 2 to verse 5, through verse 5.
This is Revelation 8, 2 through 5, from the Free Bible Version. I saw the seven angels that stand before God. They were given seven trumpets. Then another angel came and stood at the altar. He had a golden censer, and he was given a large quantity of incense to add to the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar that stands in front of the throne. The smoke of the incense rose together with the prayers of the saints before God from the hand of the angel. The angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it down upon the earth. There was the sound of thunder with lightning flashes and a terrible earthquake.
I have a question, but Floyd, you said you had several questions. So
you want me to just dump my dump truck of questions in the middle of the table, and you can take it or leave it?
Why don't you dump yours and I'll dump one of mine?
Okay. So I wrote these all down soon after a class last week, and I was like, whoa, we're not done. So here's what I wrote down. What emerges if we pull on the thread of the censer, which is incredibly fascinating to me? What is the importance and meaning of this incense? Why so much incense? What are the prayers of the saints about? Why do they need so much excessive incense? And what if censers have been misappropriated? Well, okay, let me just, this comes from an epiphany I had soon after class last week that's been resonating with me for all week. When I started thinking about this censer, literally, pictorially, you know, at least the pictures I've always seen of censers, I've probably never seen a real one, is usually like a shallow shaped bowl with chains attached to the edge of it that, you know, that you hold onto and it swings and whatever. And you put incense and coals, or maybe even hold it over a fire to heat up the incense or whatever. And then it creates smoke, which is supposed to be sweet. And symbolically in Revelation, the incense or the censers are symbols of the containers of the prayers of the saints. And we've always been taught that the incense is the righteousness of Christ, which can get into a long discussion, but I don't contest any of that. But it struck me all of a sudden, because I have been talking about the scales for quite a number of years. You know, the balance scales. I believe that Satan invented the whole concept of the balance scales. It is a counterfeit of God's design of freely receiving, freely giving. It's a counterfeit of the natural cause and effect. And it's a counterfeit because it imposes punishments for evil and it imposes rewards for good. It's all artificial, so it's a counterfeit. But a counterfeit always mimics something else that operates similarly. But if you think about a literal physical scales, a picture of the scales, and I should have brought one up because, I mean, imagine the scales you see on the court of justice, right? And it's a cross piece with a pin in the center designed to balance. And what's hanging under those cross pieces? And what is it for?
Isn't it a bowl?
It looks just like a sensor. And I said, what if Satan hijacked the sensors and attached them to a mechanical measuring device that artificially evaluates the value of people? Instead of being filled with incense and prayers and praises, they're now misappropriated to judge and determine sentences and measure and mete out equivalent amounts of evil for the evil you've done or equivalent amounts of rewards for the good you've done. That whole psycho system
punishment and reward
has done over the whole world is hijacked the sensors. And then my imagination went even further, and I discussed this with someone else. So what happened to Jesus? I mean, this just blew my mind when I let my imagination go with this. He comes to earth. They put him on the scales, right? Because every human being has to be judged on the scales. The problem is he's never done anything bad. Therefore, according to the law of the scales, Satan's laws, good must be rewarded with good. Evil must be rewarded with evil. But what did Jesus get?
Evil for good.
Mm-hmm. He got evil for good, which violated the very professed reason for the scales.
He broke the scale.
He broke the scales.
That's what I was going to say. Yes, I was thinking that this for the last several seconds.
He broke the scales, he liberates the sensors and puts them back to their original purpose.
Shit. Come here. Yeah. I wonder, is it okay if I say something? This is Julie. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. Yeah. We'd love it.
So, what this kind of verse reminds me of is kind of the sanctuary service in the Old Testament. You guys may have already talked about this, but so when the Day of Atonement came around, it was the one day a year where they had 10 days. They would blow the shofar, and then they had 10 days to make sure that they had transferred all their sins from themselves into the sanctuary. And so they would do this period of fasting and praying and making sure that their sins were all atoned for. And then when the high priest went into the most holy place, he would cast the censer down. And that symbolized that it was done. So if you didn't have your sins transferred in onto Jesus by that time, then you are, you know, I mean, the Bible doesn't really talk about people who didn't have it done. So I don't know. I assume they would be exiled from Israel. I don't know. But that's what this language reminds me of, is the high priest in the sanctuary service casting down the censer saying, okay, that's it. And so in verse 5, where it says he casts the censer
to the earth,
you know, it seems like it's symbolic of that language of the sanctuary service in the Old Testament, in the sanctuaries, the holy place in the service.
Yeah, I want to do more with that. And when Floyd gets done, there's some more Old Testament images there.
Yeah, clearly the Old Testament is the interpreter of Revelation. So,
mm-hmm. So were you finished, Floyd?
Yeah, I just dumped all those questions.
Okay.
When you trace the censors through Revelation.
Julie just answered my question of why the censor throw, what was the meaning of the censor being thrown to the earth? But I want to do some more with what she said regarding the Day of Atonement, because this is very important. The Babylonians used the censor too. And as you know, from my study of the ancient Near East and ancient Babylonia, I see Babylonian stuff all through Revelation. Because I believe that Revelation was written for the Babylonians, because the great call in Revelation is to come out of Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
And so Revelation is written for the Babylonians that it intends to call out to come out of her. The Babylonians used the censer. They would put it in the temple before the gods or before the image, which was considered a substitution for the god, a substitute for the god. And they put the censer down, or put the censer down, I should say, and put lots of incense in that place. What was it for? Well, it was for the same purpose as incantations, which the priests recited before the gods. Both the incantations and incense served to actually mollify and appease the gods. That was the purpose of incense. I don't know if you've ever been in a cloud of incense. I took a friend when I lived in Hong Kong. I took a friend to visit one of the temple complexes that had every kind of religion practically in Hong Kong available. And we were tramping along, and we came to the biggest temple in the temple complex. And they were sacrificing in a big cauldron, and they were burning lots and lots of incense. And so we decided, I think we were kind of unholy to do this, but we decided to go tramping through the entire temple. And we went up on the kind of the platform, and there was this cloud of incense. Just, it burned my eyes, choked me up. I was just amazed at how much incense there was. In the process, I had to close my eyes, it was so thick. And in the process, I looked around for my friend, who was taller than any Chinese person there. And she was gone. I didn't know where she'd gone. And I thought, I wasn't worried about myself. I knew where I was going and how to get back, but she didn't. She was had just moved there. And so I started praying that I would find her. And I finally walked out of the temple and down some steps. And there she was. I saw her standing out of the crowd. And we made our way back. But incense is in most religions that use it, except for Israel, is to appease the gods.
Mm.
Now, that is the theme. I mean, not the appeasement, but not appeasement is the theme of the Day of Atonement. And let me back up. Where is the censer used elsewhere in the Old Testament? There's a story about it.
When they grabbed the censer and rushed in to stop the plague?
No, that's one of the stories, but it's not the story I'm thinking of.
Well, there's a story of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And I don't know if that's the one you're thinking of.
No.
But one thing I think that made it significant with the censer is because it was lighted with fire from the altar, which was lit from God.
Right.
So in that particular story, which doesn't sound like the story you're thinking of, what made it a problem was they didn't use that fire. And that's what kind of got them in trouble.
Mm-hmm. They were drunk. That was the other problem.
Big problem. Yeah.
Okay. You're thinking of Nadab and Abihu,
right? Nadab and Abihu.
You're thinking of Nadab and Abihu?
Mm-hmm.
Korah, Dathan, and Abiram was the rebellion. Nadab and Abihu was the censor taken in.
Sorry, yes, I have the names.
I was thinking of Nadab and Abihu. So
yeah, Nadab and Abihu. And they
I want to talk about the strange fire. The strange fire was the fire they created instead of the fire off the altar.
Mm-hmm.
They created their own fire.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it's always been interpreted. But a couple of scholars did an intertextual study with the word strange as it's used in Ezekiel and other places. And it actually refers to child sacrifice.
Mm.
I don't know if we can take it that far.
Mm.
But I do think what's happening is that Nadab and Abihu, drunk as they were, went into the most holy place with the censer of this, with the wrong kind of fire to appease Yahweh.
Mm.
If you go in to appease someone who already loves you, that love is a consuming fire.
Mm-hmm.
And you die.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened to Nadab and Abihu. They died on the temple floor. It didn't consume their flesh, because they took them out in their tunics,
mm-hmm,
outside the camp. Now, if you go to the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16, it starts by referencing that story. Now, after it says, let me get to that passage.
So it's the mindset of thinking you have to appease that actually becomes the fatal element.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Exactly.
That,
mm-hmm.
Man, that.
But it gets even better. So follow me. In Leviticus 16, it says, after the death of Aaron's two sons, which happened when they approached the Lord and died. God is saying, okay, I've got to explain how to come into my presence, because the question in everybody's minds had to have been, how can we come into the presence of God and not be consumed? And so,
Micah 6:6-8.
Yeah. So what God does is say, okay, here is the protocol you follow to come into the presence of the most holy place, into the most holy place. And only the priest can do it, and he can only do it once a year.
Mm-hmm.
That will mitigate everybody dying that goes in there, because the mindset of the people is still to appease God. And of course, the question is, the text nowhere says that God was angry when Nadab and Abihu died. Mm-hmm. Nowhere says that. The whole book of Genesis never portrays God as angry.
You know, that story of Nadab and Abihu, and I've talked about the two-year Bible study that God gave me. That was the first story in my reading in that 2 years that he just threw it in my face. Because if you remove the chapter break, it's stunning. At the end of the previous chapter is like the inauguration of the sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And it describes, you know, the fire or the cloud came
fire
down.
Down
the glory was revealed.
Yeah.
Fire came out from the cloud and consumed the sacrifice, and all the people shouted and fell down and worshiped. And it's like, wow, what a worship service, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the very next thing it talks about is Nadab and Abihu take their incense, go in there, and then word for word, it repeats what it just said about the
fire came out from Yahweh.
Fire came out and consumed them.
Yes.
But mm-hmm. everything was word for word. And then God just said, look, it wasn't any different. The only difference was the recipients.
Right.
It was their disposition. And it was, you know, I began slowly starting to see that it is not God's anger lashing out to punish and burn people who have offended him.
It's the natural consequence.
It is our allergic reaction to walking into a presence of love so intense that if you are not completely synchronized with it, it's like grabbing a high power line.
Okay, let me pause and move into another story. And then I'm going to come back to Nadav and Abihu and the Day of Atonement.
May I say a comment?
Yes.
I just wanted to say, you know, in that story of the sons of Aaron, it also, in a way, it seems that, and maybe you guys have talked about this already, but it's like selfish works of self salvation.
Self-righteousness.
Right, versus God working in our behalf.
Right, so, there's that aspect too. Yes, definitely.
So the whole sanctuary service is a service, it's so defined in detail by God to let us know this. None of this is of you.
Right.
All
being. Right. Well, appeasement is an attempt to work our way.
Exactly.
And it's a slap in God's face because he already loves us.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't need to be appeased. So,
I was going to say right down to the, we were just talking about even the, what was in the incense was dictated. You know, it was this amount of frankincense and myrrh. I mean, it was supposed to be used in that exact manner for that exact amount for that reason only. And so it was not supposed to be any at all works of ourself. It was all works of God through Jesus Christ. That's it. Everything pointed to Christ.
Yeah.
And it should have no bearing, no man in it at all.
Yeah.
Jean?
Yeah, I totally agree with it. Yeah, Bill?
Before you go on and then come back, I was just thinking there's the recurring theme from creation, you know, in the biblical narrative, that you have the garden, and then there's a disconnect, a broken relationship, and their light or the clothing of light is lost, and things like this. That it seems like there's this way, and the creation of the temple or sanctuary with its gates and courtyards and most holy place is a way of like a word picture of how to come in to God unshielded. And the realization that which is out of harmony with an unshielded God ceases to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not punishment. It's not anger or vindictiveness. And here God is doing this word picture with a people steeped in, some other story of appeasement, of all this. And so he's having to use a word picture to help them relate while painting a different picture of who he really is. And I'm reminded of the children of Moses, and it's not just Moses, Joshua went through this, you know, each prophet went through something similar. But Moses, God wanted to come down to the whole community. And the community said, no, 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 no. You scare us. So let Moses go to you. So Moses went with the 70 or whatever, part way up. And then they all say, whatever you say, we will do. And he comes down with the 10 commandments. And he's shining a reflective shine. And it's so bright that they ask him to shield himself. And yet it's dim compared to the reality.
Okay. You're taking two stories here, and I'm going to take one of them.
Okay.
The shining face of Moses has to do with when God revealed his glory to him.
True, true.
After he broke the Ten Commandments.
That's true.
And it was not his face, it was his backside hidden by her hand.
That was God's backside, yes.
Yeah.
And we're going to examine that in Exodus 33. And 34.
Right. But he still lit up like a Christmas tree.
Yes.
Brighter.
So, Moses starts pleading with God in chapter 33 because God has said, I can't go in the midst of the people or I will destroy them. That is not because God wants to destroy them. It's because they can't bear his presence.
Yes.
So how can he go among them? So God, Moses says to the Lord, "See, you have said to me, 'Bring up this people,' but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, 'I know you by name,' and you have also found favor in my sight." I'm in 33, starting in verse 12, and I'm now down in 13. "Now, if I have found favor in your sight, show me your ways that I may know you and find favor in your sight. Consider too that this nation is your people." He said, "My presence will go with you and I will give you rest." And he said to him, "If your presence will not go, and do not carry us up from here. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, and I and your people, unless you go with us? In this way, we will be distinct, I and your people, from every people on the face of the earth." And that is absolutely the truth. The one of the big distinctions between Israel and all the other nations is that God picked a people and went with them. And you just don't have that in any other religion in the ancient Near East.
That relationship is the opposite of all the pagan gods.
It's exactly.
They're like dictators.
So the Lord said to Moses, "I will do the very thing that you have asked, for you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name." That's "I know you by character." This name becomes character. Moses said, "Show me your glory, I pray." And he said, "I will make all my goodness pass before you. And I will proclaim before you the name the Lord," or the name Yahweh. By the way, the Lord is not Yahweh. That's not what it means. Lord means Lord, Master, whatever. Has to do with power.
Hierarchy.
Yahweh is a form of the verb to be. I am who I am. And what happened is that during the exile, the Jews got so worried about keeping the law that they began to distance themselves from saying the name of God, lest they take his name in vain. So they substituted for it Adonai. Every time they saw Yahweh, they substituted for the word Yahweh as Adonai. That got translated as Kurios in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Bible. It was accomplished by 200 BC. That in turn got translated into the Latin Vulgate as Lord, and finally into the English versions. So every time you see Lord with little lower and little uppercase letters, every time you see that, that's a substitution for Yahweh. Yahweh is already a different term than "I am who I am." That would be pronounced differently. So God already supplied that to Moses in chapter 3 of Exodus. He says, the Lord said, "I will proclaim before you the name Yahweh, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and show mercy to whom I will show mercy." Where's the justice? This is all my goodness. Gracious, mercy.
Is justice doing the right thing? Sorry.
But he said, "You cannot see my face, for no one shall see me and live." It isn't that God says, "I don't want you to see my face. You'll be sinning if you see my face. I'm going to kill you if you see my face." That's not what it says at all. No one can see my face and live.
And that's really very parallel to "don't eat of that tree or you'll die."
Yeah. And Yahweh continued, "See, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock. And while my glory passes by, I will put you in the left cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face you shall not see." Now, you have to understand something. In order to grasp what God is saying, you have to understand something about the ancient Near East. To look on the face of someone was to receive his favor, If he turned his face away from you or turned his back to you, which I've had someone do to me once, if he turned his back to you, that meant he was angry with you and probably would take your head off or whatever. So when David says of Absalom, he shall not see my face, he's expressing, he's turning his face away from him. He's turning his back to him. And he's angry with him. You need to understand that. It isn't God's backside that is lethal. It isn't his turning away from us that's lethal. It's not anger that's lethal. It is his mercy and his graciousness and his goodness of his face. It's totally counterintuitive. And that's what God is trying to convey to Moses.
There was a couple things in that reading I wanted to point out that I hadn't noticed one of them before. Seems like I get more out of it when I hear somebody else read it. But he says, I know you by name.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, that whole conversation just really hits me hard. But then when Moses basically says, well, I want to know your name.
Mm-hmm.
You know my name. Why can't this be mutual? Because your name is your character. It is your face. And then he's like, well, I can't give it all to you because you can't handle it. But then when he talks about, I'm going to put you in the cleft of the rock. And a week or two ago, suddenly that hit me. We just like, oh yeah. So he found a crack in the boulders up. No. This is symbolic. The cleft in the rock that hid the face of God was the Ten Commandments written on stone that hides us from seeing the truth, the full expression of God's face. And it wasn't until Jesus comes to reveal in a safe way, in safe mode, you know, the full expression of love, because before that, it's under the law, which is the cleft of the rock. I don't know. It seems to fit to me.
Well, I think it's a good parallel. I think of the cleft of the rock as a safe place because it's mm-hmm. talked about that way in the Psalms. I think Psalm 91. Oh, and of course, we have a hymn on something about that and the cleft of the rock. But it is true if you go to the veil put over their faces in 2 Corinthians 3. I think you have a nice parallel there. So he has him cut the two tablets himself. God cut the original ones. Moses had to cut the second ones. And I really have to admit, God never told Moses to break those Ten Commandments.
That's right.
First time. Moses perceived God as angry,
mm-hmm.
and he got angry, and that's what led him to break the Ten Commandments. But God didn't say he was angry. He says, step aside so I can get angry, as if Moses could keep him from getting angry, you know. And it seems to me very clearly that God was not angry, but he was testing Moses. Can mm-hmm. you handle this? Can you forgive these people? No, he didn't know. He didn't understand. He hadn't come to know God that well. And that's why he asked to know him more fully. In verse 5, chapter 34, the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name the Lord. So Yahweh descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name Yahweh. Yahweh passed before him and proclaimed Yahweh, Yahweh, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Keeping steadfast love for thousands, a thousandth generation, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but yet by no means clearing the guilty, but visiting the iniquity of the parents upon the children, the children's children to the third and fourth generation. What that suggests is not punishing children, which is how one versions mm-hmm. translate visiting. That word visiting in its cognate in Akkadian never means to punish. Now, it does in contextual understanding seem to mean that, but I think what it means is I'm visiting on you the consequences from generation to generation, but I'm stopping it at the third and fourth generation. So you do some scientific review. They've done studies that show that pedophiles who are typically have been molested by pedophiles themselves. That if, say, their grandfather molested his son, and then the grandfather molested the grandchild, which is a story I read this in, it's usually the third generation or the fourth generation that stops that cycle of pedophilia and is set free. And I told this to a counselor friend of mine. And she said, you know, I don't know of any studies for abuse, just, you know, physical abuse, emotional abuse, and so on. But she said, it's been my experience as a counselor that at the third or fourth generation, the abuse cycle ends. And that's really, I think, how it's happened in my family. My great-grandfather was a very abusive man. He beat his children every time he came home from work. So they learned to hide under the house when they saw him coming across the fields. When he was converted, which he was, he stopped his abusive ways and actually spoiled his youngest children. But it led my grandfather to be abusive. He was very abusive to his foster children, to the point where my grandmother threatened to call the police if he didn't stop beating them. And I think of my mother, who's now at the third generation, after reading Child Guidance, completely changed her ways of discipline. And I was a beneficiary of that change. That's kind of where I'm going with this visiting the iniquity of the fathers. I think God is actually setting in a control against a kind of boundary against this just going ad infinitum without a break.
I think that when it says, which does not clear the guilty, to me, that is saying, just because you're forgiven unconditionally does not negate the law of cause and effect.
No.
I think that's what he's saying. Yeah. I am not suspending the law of effect. You might shield us from a large portion of it, but he is not nullifying that law.
Yeah.
And that's what he's, I think that's the point of that, that, well, you know, I grew up with much harsher views of God. And so that was just like, basically, well, if you can convince me, I'll forgive you, but it's going to be very grudging.
Or as my third and fourth grade teacher said to a child that she spanked, this is in the days when teachers spanked children. She had spanked a child and he was sobbing at his desk, and he finally went up to her and said, Mrs. Graham, I'm sorry. And she said, well, I'll forgive you if you never do it again. And I remember even as a 9-year-old, I was horrified. I was like, that's not forgiveness. In my family, that wasn't forgiveness. And I just, I never will forget that. It just burned its way in my mind. Now, I finished that piece. Let's go back to Leviticus 16. The Nadab and Abihu story has raised the question, what does it take to come into the presence of this God who consumes you if you're messing up in any way? What does it take? What do we have to do? And so God starts in Tell your brother Aaron not to come just at any time into the sanctuary inside the curtain before the mercy seat that is upon the ark, or he will die. Don't just come when you want to. Come when I specify it, because you need preparation before you come into my presence. And then he tells that preparation. I'm not going to go through that, but I'm going to move or jump over it to the two goats. There are two goats. There's one for Yahweh, and there's one for Azazel. And one day I sat down with that name, and I studied it in the Hebrew, and I studied it and studied it. And I finally came to the conclusion that I thought maybe it was a strong goat, because Oz, related to Azazel, or Oz in Azazel, means strong. So I thought maybe it meant strong goat. When I studied that linguistically and grammatically, it didn't work. And so finally I decided that it really is Akkadian. And in Akkadian, part of it is Akkadian. In Akkadian, there are multiple words for anger. I once went through a small dictionary of all Akkadian words and tried to glean out of it all the words for anger. And I came up with as many as I came up with in the Hebrew Bible out of Young's Analytical Concordance. I have since acquired a book of English words for Akkadian words, so that you can look for English words and find out how many Akkadian words there are for that word. And I have found that there are more than I had been able to glean. The Akkadian word, the two most popular words in Akkadian for anger is Azazu. Sounds like Azazel. And Agagu. And those two words are different from each other. Agagu means a flare of anger, an emotional response to something. Ticks you off, makes you angry, and you explode. That's Agagu. Azazu is a steady, constant attribute of anger. It is actually part of your character to be angry. Now, when God makes himself known to Moses, he does not use anger as part of his character. It is missing. He doesn't even use justice as part of his character. It is missing. So, what is Azazel? Well, Jewish tradition has long been that the goat for Azazel was a demon goat, which fits the Adventist view very well. So we have long taught that the goat for Azazel represents Satan. Right? But what does Azazel mean? Well, if you take it from the word Azazel, Azazazu in Akkadian, it means angry God. And I taught that to my students for some years. And then one day I thought, you know, I'm the only one probably in the whole scholarly community that sees it this way, that, you know, I better be careful and not teach that anymore. And about a year later, I didn't teach it 1 year. And a year later, or before the next year, I came across a Hebrew scholar, a Jewish scholar in Israel, an article he had written on the goat Azazel and what it represented. And he's the one that outlined the traditional view of it being a demon goat. But he said that it came from Azazu and Elu, which became in Hebrew El. Elu is God in Akkadian. El is the Hebrew version of Elu. So it's Azazel is Azazu plus El or El, Elu. And it means fierce God.
Mm.
That's what he said. And I was like, I'm not the only one who sees this. And he admitted that it was a metathesized form, meaning that two letters got flipped, which made it all the more difficult to understand what it meant. Who's the angry god in the Old Testament?
The demon god.
So what God did with the Day of Atonement is to clarify, no, it doesn't say I was angry when Nadab and Abihu died. I wasn't angry. It just happened because they were out of harmony with my love. And here's the angry god. And I'm not even going to slaughter him.
Yeah.
Just take him out in the desert and let him go.
Get rid of your angry face of God permanently.
Yeah. Yeah.
But don't kill him, because then you become like him.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I find it loaded, because isn't that everything is put onto that one and sent out of the camp? So even not only is God saying that about himself, it seems like he's saying, take that out of yourself as well. And it just reminds me again, when in the garden, what happened, and there's the whole blame thing, and that's the scapegoating mechanism at work. And in the Free Bible version, Jonathan is rendering the Azazel as the scapegoat. And it's like, it's just a theme, a callback to the garden issue, and a call forward or foreshadowing of the incarnation process, that God is trying to remove our mindset about him, our mindset about ourselves. I just see it all at work in this process. And so I come back and I'm wondering about the incense and the throwing it down, because that sort of started our foray into the
Well, see, that's why I think, because the Babylonians use incense to appease the gods. It's not that in Revelation.
Is it sort of, it is finished? Like, this is not
what it is? It is sort of finished. I'm letting go.
I got one more piece.
In a sense, it's a subtle, this is my anger. It's giving up. It's letting go. It's saying it's finished. It's done.
I got one more piece of puzzle that might connect some of this, because I'm still sitting here puzzling over what's the casting down about. And suddenly, when Bill, you were talking, and the story of Azazel, and it's like, wait a minute, there's a common thread here. Azazel is cast out of the camp. Satan is cast out of heaven. In Ezekiel, he's cast out of his grave. He can't even be in the grave. He's cast out of the grave. They don't want him there.
You mean
and now there's this censor being cast. Wait, there's just a whole lot of casting going on here, and I think they're all related to each other.
Well, this this casting out, and maybe it's not the same thing as this, but I did a study of the fall of a person or entity or being. The flood occurred when the earth became filled with violence. Ezekiel, the king of Tyre, falls when he turns to violence. It says, the text says, you became filled with violence and you sinned. And so every time you have a casting out or a fall, it's usually because sin has been made manifested in violence. So I don't know if there's a connection there or not. I do think it's going to be later on in Revelation when the fall of Babylon takes place.
Irma was wondering about why they needed to cast lots for the two goats.
Oh, Azazel and the Yahweh goat.
Yeah, it's like, did they look exactly the same or something?
Well, that's the way they did things to choose, to make sure that God was the one choosing.
Mm.
It's a form of divination. It's a sanctified form of divination.
So what role did incense have in pagan religions, and how is God reframing it?
Well, that's what I was saying earlier. In Babylonia, Babylonia is all I know. But in Babylonia, it was to soothe the gods and keep them from being angry.
So God talks about offerings and everything as a sweet smelling, you know, in my nostrils.
Yeah. Sounds like he needs it because he'll be angry if he doesn't have it.
And yet we know that it's different.
Jacob Milgram, who's an eminent Jewish scholar, who wrote a 3-volume Anchor Bible commentary on Leviticus, maintains that this was originally did come out of appeasement languaging, but that by the time it made its way into the Bible, it no longer had that connotation. And it does seem that way. It seems kind of like a stale reference to that, but it doesn't have the intent, the reality behind it anymore. But just, this is how you please me. This is the offering that will please me.
So the much incense, I guess I'm still a little fuzzy, or maybe it's supposed to be fuzzy, I don't know. But, you know, in this chapter, this angel has much incense, and I guess I should check again to see what he did with it. No, he added it to the prayers of the saints. So that's clearly what he did with it.
Mm-hmm.
It almost seems like there could be multiple and very different applications of this symbol.
It could, but you know, it's the smoke of the incense comes from the fire on the altar. And that altar was burning to light the sanctuary. Partly, of course, the candlestick did too. But also, it was provided a shield from God's glory.
Mm.
And I think that was its role.
So much incense is sort of like God putting his hand over Moses on the rock?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh. But then why does he throw it to the earth?
Because he's no longer any need for intercession.
Ooh.
There's no longer a need for a shield.
Oh, now you just triggered a whole Adventist paradigm.
This is a parallel to the last plagues.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how does it relate to the throwing down of the incense in the Day of Atonement procedure?
Well, you know, I don't know where Julie got that. Throwing down of the incense, because I've never read that in conjunction with the Day of Atonement.
Okay.
I don't know if that's in later Jewish tradition.
Didn't that happen on the water when Jesus cried out at the temple, "If any man thirst, let him come to me"? And it's described as this ritual where this grand, all the torches and all that stuff, and then in the priest would slam the censer on the pavement that makes a huge sound, and it was a thing that they did every year.
And see, I'm not familiar with that ritual.
I think Ellen White describes it actually.
Okay, it could be, and that could be that it did happen in the Day of Atonement. I just never had that.
But I don't think it was connected necessarily to the Day of Atonement It had to do with water. They drew water out of somewhere, and then they poured it out, and then he threw the censer down, and it was, you know, it was like a very popular spectacle thing that they did every year there. But it highlighted everybody's emptiness, is how Ellen White put it. And in this sort of just, you know, it's just a big show, but it's not doing anything for us. And then Jesus cries out as if he can read everybody's thoughts. If anybody's thirsty, come to me, and I will give him water of life.
Mm-hmm. I'm the censor.
Yeah, yeah. Or maybe Jesus, maybe the censer being cast down is Jesus being cast down to the earth with much incense. Like slammed down.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Barbara.
Well, you said that the incense to God is, it is finished. Didn't you say that?
I think maybe Julie said that.
Oh, because that made me think of one of the three gifts at Jesus' birth was frankincense, and then all the way to the cross, it is finished. And maybe this whole thing of the censer being mixed with the prayer of saints is God saying, I hear you, and it is finished. That's just what struck me.
You know,
it's a symbol.
I like that. I like that because I see so many of, I see so many allusions in Revelation to the death of Jesus.
Well, the, it does even the earthquake and everything in that one chapter in 8, you know, 8:3 through whatever it is, 5.
Jesus cried, it is finished. What was finished was not his intercession, but his
representation.
The plan of salvation.
Non-appeasement plan of salvation.
Non-appeasement plan of salvation, yes. Yes, to clarify. I like that.
Too, a thought that comes to me as we're trying to view this contextually, you know, when we focused on Revelation 7, where it talks about this incredible perspective where God says, you know, you're not going to be hungry, you're not going to be thirsty, the sun's not going to beat down on you. You know, the Lamb at the center of the throne is the shepherd. He leads them to springs of living water. God wipes away every tear. And then you have this stunned silence, which we talked about, this sense of worship. And then as you move right into right before the trumpets, which my understanding in the Old Testament, these were warnings to get everybody's attention so you could be safe from enemy attacks. And it seems to me that God is, again, trying to move and warn and prepare his people. And he's paying this intimate attention to prayers. It's right in God's presence, right in front of the throne. And then there's this additional drama that continues to unfold. So just is so, I think it speaks so well of God being so concerned about us, what's going on for us, and that heaven's movement is intricately tied to his concern for us and what's going on for us. And that, anyway, I think that's part of what the censer and mixing with the prayers is supposed to symbolize, that God acts in response to our petitions, our requests for God to move, especially the God of grace, who is not vindictive and is not angry. He's the God we've waited for, who's the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world.
You know,
I think that's a nice overview of encapsulation of the meaning of the whole process.
That just gave me a whole nother perspective, because now I'm glad you stepped back and took that long shot at it, because now I'm seeing something that I hadn't seen before. Because this is flowing right out of the 144,000 who are famous for the new song.
Mm-hmm.
The incense needs to be added, much incense needs to be added to our prayers. Because most of my life, most of the prayers that I've done and I hear people around me are begging prayers. Mm-hmm. Constantly trying to manipulate God, trying to change his mind, trying to beg him. And the new song is all about, you need to have praise as the all your prayers and petitions are wrapped in thanksgiving and praise and focusing on the goodness of God. That's the incense. Our prayers need radical overhaul with tons of incense, which is seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And then all this stuff will be added to you. that's the recipe right there, is we need a whole lot more incense added to our prayers so they can actually start being effective. And then things can move forward. If we would just stop begging all the time and start praising God.
And one perspective that I'm just trying to add, which was new for me, when Jennings in paraphrases Revelation 8:6 with warnings. He said, then the seven angels holding the seven trumpets prepared to sound them, which represents seven warning messages of truth, trumpeting the approaching in and exposing Satan's counterfeits to God's remedy. So, and Siegfried Tonstedt also seemed to re-echo that maybe we've interpreted the seven trumpets incorrectly, and that they're warnings to try to continue to save people from the lies that have been believed, which kind of fit with, you know, 144,000 and what they're supposed to be doing, which is God's still pulling out all the stops to reach as many people as he possibly can to win from Satan's counterfeit of this angry, vindictive God who destroys.
You know, Gene, you mentioned something that now makes sense even more. In this list of casting, this angel, this is like a summary of what's coming. He casts the bowls full of incense and prayers to the earth. All seven in chapter 16 are each of the angels pouring out the contents of their bowls on the earth. So this is like a summary of the seven bowls being poured out, and the contents of those bowls are the incense and the prayers of the saints. And I'm convinced that is exactly what's poured out on the earth. It's the reaction of the wicked to all this positive views of God and all this praising and blessing God, when their view of God is so dark and angry that it just makes them furious and angry, and they react in ways we call plagues, and then we blame God for it just like they do. But the contents that's being poured out, which is in this censer, much incense, is the graciousness of God, which they can't handle.
Mm-hmm. I just was saying, truth divides. How do people react to truth?
Mm. Yeah.
It seems like the people who react to the graciousness of God are usually the religious people.
Yes. Yeah.
I would like to propose an additional element that we have overlooked on incense. The incense, I believe, is God's way of offsetting and rebuking Satan's, and we're not come to it yet, but in chapter 12, he's the accuser of the brother.
Mm-hmm.
So it's putting to rest his false claims about us. Mm. And even his true claims that God has forgiven us from. So I see it as kind of what is at work in Zechariah 3, when Satan is accusing Joshua the high priest.
Mm-hmm.
And God says, Lord, rebuke you. The Lord who's chosen Israel, rebuke you. Is not this a brand plucked from the burning? So there's all kinds of little pieces in there that I think we really cannot afford to take this out of the context of the great controversy.
Mm.
And I think that's what Nancy did so wonderfully, is to take it and put it back in that context,
mm-hmm.
via Sigva and Jim Jennings. So I appreciate that.
You know, another link to the much incense could be that where sin abounds, grace much more abounds.
Yeah, I like that.
And somebody pointed out that heaping coals of fire on your head, as describing the vengeance of God, It's the fire. It's the coals of incense. Mm-hmm.
What did Isaiah have touch his lips, and where did it come from?
A coal off the altar.
The incense.
And that was his atonement.
He doesn't was made... say it was, which altar does, is it? Is it?
It doesn't say. I don't think.
Just off the altar.
Yeah.
It could be the altar of incense. It could be the altar of burnt offering.
Well, for me, again, he's articulating and out of alignment. And the touching, the coal touching his lips is his adjustment. So wherever it comes from, the idea for me is we're being met where we are in these stories. And some stories, it's really for one person, but we can still get something from it. So Isaiah is always encouragement to me that that's one single atonement theory, you know, out of many. And maybe the idea that God is who he said he is, long-suffering, loving, merciful. Right. So God is that. And when we are out of harmony with that, we misperceive both our standing and who he is. And so something we need is available to change our minds about that situation.
We need a lot of incense.
We need what we need. And it's a sad statement that it's a lot of incense.
Because the incense really is the truth about God's love.
And that's exactly what the world needs. The truth about who God is.
Yeah.
But like Paul says, it stinks to those who are rejecting God's mercy. And yet it's a savor of life to those who are being saved. It all depends how you react to the incense. You know, it's either burning your eyes and it stinks because you hate incense, or it's ecstasy.
So taking that and saying the incense is now thrown, I mean, every metaphor has its limits. Where does chapter 8, and I know we've said multiple, so I'm still trying to get it in the context of the cosmic conflict, historicist traditional views, and whatever else might happen. You know, we're talking about the 144,000 being sealed, but then that is unique, it seems like. If there are trumpets that are of warning and bowls that are of warning, when is it so late or too late to come around?
I think when people have come to the place where they act out their picture of God, their false picture, their picture of their false God as angry, violent, severe, and so on. To me, that is at least very close to the point of no return. Because at least in my study of abuse, sin as abuse, and salvation as recovery from abuse, in that anatomy of a fall, you start out with pride, go to externalism, and go to control, and then power, and then supremacy. No, supremacy, and then power, and falsification, and finally imaging. It's that point of imaging when we become like the God we worship and admire. That's the harvest. That's when things mature to the point where they are revealed.
So in chapter 8, we're having these warnings. And so every human being seems to have a different place where they've hardened their heart or allowed their heart to soften. And so as we're coming up and we're seeing this pregnant pause in chapter 8, reflection, whatever it might be, of preceding experiences, I guess I'm processing the prayers of the saints. Some of what we've had have sounded vengeful.
That's where the incense comes in. It's to convert their prayers.
Okay. And I know that's sort of what I'm just still processing it. I've got to make sense of it. So
that's when the Holy Spirit has to interpret our prayers to convey what we should have or didn't know how to say.
That's all part of the incense.
Yeah. And I don't think we can view these things as concretely sequential either.
Yeah.
I think just like in a good movie, there's flashes, there's flashbacks, there's insertions. Sometimes they'll start in the middle of the story and then go back to the beginning of the story for half the movie and then jump to the end of the story. And yeah, all those things I see happening in this book. Mm-hmm. And then there's little summary bits, which, you know, this angel could be almost like just a summary segment. The whole interlude between the sixth and the seventh seal is an interlude. It's an interjection, and that shows up in other places, you know, between sixes and sevens.
Siegfried Tonstad does a really good focus on those interludes, as you just referenced, and talks about what's the mission. What's the method, and talks about how, you know, the mission reflects the good news about who God is, and the methods are aligned, the message and the methods align with the lamb that allowed himself to be slaughtered.
That's right.
And it's nonviolent, and it's, you know, letting each individual choose. Anyway, so he talks about these interims between the sixth and the seventh, and how it goes back to review what's the method, what's the mission, what's the, you know, how does that all align with God's mission and methods and message? Yeah.
M&M&M.
Yes.
Well, I'm wondering if it's a little after five. I'm wondering if this might be a good place to stop. We can start with verse 5, go to the incense being thrown down, incensor being thrown down.
Well, I just want to thank you, Jean. You know, this class is, I don't know what words to say. You know, the atmosphere here has been cordial. All different kinds of different angles and views, and everything's encouraged. And, you know, the vibes here are just so positive. I just have to say thank you.
I have to say thank the Holy Spirit, because I asked for him to take charge before I ever meet with you. And I want him to be the one guiding us into truth. I don't have it of myself. I get it.
Thank you for letting me join you too.
I had to keep muted
most of the time because my puppy is making a lot of noise. And so anyway, but I've enjoyed listening to all of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lenora. We appreciate having you.
Great to have face and other voices.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is nice to have that.
I wanted to say hi. Can you see me?
Yeah. Yes. You're deep in the weeds.
I'll get rid of that background. I worked diligently to get my camera up this week, and I wanted to thank Floyd for his patience, because I kept bugging him on his daily routine. Can you hear me now? Can you see me now? But one of the things that I like about the call is the ability to sit back and listen. And it has the tendency for me to bounce a lot of things into my frontal cortex. I have a chance to marinate and salivate a little bit, I guess is the best way to put it. And I agree that the spirit is present because for me, it's giving me the ability to reflect a lot more.
Mm.
And this is, I'm going through a revelation class with Floyd on Thursday evenings. And we're a little bit ahead. And I didn't join him until, well, I joined him after the start of his class. So this is kind of like coming behind. So I can relate to Floyd when he says, you know how that story is, you know, it may not be a marked timeline because they sometimes move it, like he said. But thankfully what they have the spirit to put a monogram at the bottom of the, you know, or an encapsulation to tell you 2 years prior, 10 years further, you know. So it gives you some way of following along. So I'm amazed that you began again at 8 and you read the first four verses and we're right back to where we were the last call. So I want to say shalom and welcome to the newcomers and thanks for having me. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Bill or William. I think you like to be called William.
I'm William on here because there's my brother over there. Am I doing the right? Oh, okay. I got to figure which is right.
Which Bill?
Our gracious host.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's fine.
All right.
Well, shalom.
Shalom, Irma.
I've learned a few things here, and it's very interesting.
Well, it's going to get more and more interesting.
I just wondered if there was more to the two goats, you know. And it's been eye-opener for some of those terms that I haven't heard before.
Mm.
Yeah. I'm from the Adventist background, and I know nothing. I don't have any biblical background much except college, you know. So this has been very, and of course, Brother Floyd's classes, they're just beautiful.
Mm.
So he introduced me to this class, and I'm learning some too. Okay. Because I did not catch Brother Floyd's until later. And he had already covered chapter 8, I think, on Revelation. Mm. So I went back to his notes also to see if I could contribute something to the class.
It takes many people, and we can thank Sigve Tonstad and Ted Jennings for their contributions to this class too.
Sure.
Yeah.
And John Pauline is doing a great job too. John Pauline is doing a lot of great contributions to this too.
All right, let's have prayer. Okay. And I wish you all a wonderful week.
To you.
Gracious Father, we thank you for being with us this afternoon. What a pleasure it is to study with you as our guide.
Mm-hmm.
The things that come to our minds that we wouldn't think otherwise. We ask that you will continue to lead us into all truth, that you will be with us through this week, that we may not lose anything of what we've learned today. In Jesus' name, amen.